Let's see. How are we doing for time? I'm not sure how long I'm going to take getting through the Book of Ruth. There is a little section here on the PLO and Israel, but it may well appear in the worldwide news. So I think we'll go directly to the Book of Ruth, brethren. Mrs. Rose Kennedy wanted to know how to stay awake during Bible study. My suggestion is sit at the front row and then you're close enough for me to throw Webster's Dictionary of the English Language. I found out tonight, too, why during the final half hour of Bible study everybody looks over my head. There's a clock over there, which I did not realize until this evening. Well, you better make sure you make eye contact with me during the final half hour. Of course, a lot of people, when they sleep, they just hold their head down like this and pretend they're reading their Bible. And some of them, they look like they're stargazing, and that's when they're watching the clock. The reason I'd like to deal with the Book of Ruth tonight, brethren, is because it relates to the Feast of Pentecost that is upcoming. And I mentioned to you that, in fact, I think it was the first sermon of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, that of the five books of the Megaloth that the Jews have from the Bible, the Song of Solomon is read during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the Book of Ruth is read during the Feast of Pentecost. Pentecost celebrates the end of the wheat and barley harvest, and the Book of Ruth has a harvest theme. We're going to see that what takes place, the story takes place during the first fruits harvest of the year, the barley harvest. And as we understand, God's church represents the first fruits harvest of God's plan of salvation for mankind. Ruth was a Gentile, and she was married into Israel. And so what we're taught by the story of the book is that the Gentiles are also going to be a part of God's plan of salvation, that they become spiritual Israelites, and that they are to be married to Jesus Christ. So Ruth here in the story is a type of the church, Boaz a type of Jesus Christ. A loose type, but they are types nevertheless. And it is the second book in the Megaloth, as I mentioned, and it is read at Pentecost by the Jews because of its spring harvest theme. So as we approach the day of Pentecost, it would be good for us to study the book and to begin to put into our minds the meaning of the upcoming feast of Pentecost that lies just ahead of us. Now, it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled. So this is during the time of the book of Judges that precedes Ruth. And in fact, it was the early period of Judges, it seems, that the story took place. There was a famine in the land of Israel. Remember, there were times when Israel, during the period of the Judges, had to be chastised by God because of their lack of obedience. And then God would raise up a judge to deliver them from their slavery or their problems. Well, at this time, there was a famine. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah. Remember that we're dealing with Bethlehem here throughout the story. And I mentioned to you that Boaz would be a type of Jesus Christ because Bethlehem figures throughout this book when we find Ruth and Naomi returning to the land of Israel. A certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. Now, he left the land in a time of famine. That was certainly permitted in the book of Genesis. You find Abraham going down to Egypt. You find Isaac going down to Egypt at time of famine. You find later on that Jacob came down to Egypt at a time of famine. But God had said after he had brought Israel up out of Egypt in the great Exodus, they were not to return there again. Now, this man was not returning to Egypt, but he was leaving Israel, which was now the promised land. Israel had come out of Egypt, entered their promised land, and that's where God intended that they should stay to maintain the inheritance of land that he should give to them. This man wanted to escape his responsibilities. Instead of staying there and pleading with God for mercy and forgiveness that God might bring an end to the famine, he decided just to move out of the country. Now, we're going to see as we explore the story that the evidence is pretty clear that he was quite a wealthy man. In fact, he was related to Boaz, who was also a very wealthy individual. It would seem, and the Bible story brings this out, but also the Jewish commentators, that he left Israel, the promised land that God had given to him and to his fathers, because being a rich individual, he didn't want to help out the poor people and the destitute. He got tired of the fact that so many people were poor and were coming to him for help, evidently. And so, being fairly prosperous, he decided that he would just move to another country, and in this case, to a Gentile country. Now, we're going to see that as a result of that move, God cursed him. Instead of staying and helping his own people and weathering the situation and praying for God's forgiveness that the famine could end, he just went off to take care of himself and leave everybody else behind to look after themselves instead of him helping them. The name of the man was Elimelech, which means my God is king. Ironic, because God was not his king. He was his own king and master. The name of his wife, Naomi, which means the sweet one or the pleasant one. And the name of his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem. Now, Mahlon literally means sickness, and Chilion means vanishing. These were names given to them either because of the sad plight of Israel at this time, being in famine, or as foretelling their early death and childlessness. God cursed the sons as well as the father. All three were going to die as a result of this move. And they were to die childless. The name of this family was to be eradicated from the memory of Israel, except for two women in the family who went back, and things turned out right as a result of their, Naomi's repentance at least. And God was able to bless and turn from the curse to the blessing. So verse 3, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. And they took the wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, which means a deer or a hind. And the name of the other was Ruth. Now there's some question as to these names, as they're Moabite names. Bullinger says the name Ruth means beauty. New Bible commentary says the two names and their meaning is actually unknown. I have one other meaning for Ruth from, I believe, the Sansino commentaries, the Jewish commentaries on this section of the Bible, that Ruth means friendship. And I would fancy that that is the true meaning of the name, because she became a true friend to her mother-in-law, Naomi, and a friend of Israel. And the Bible talks about people who obey God becoming the friends of God. And that is what Ruth became later on in the story. And they dwelled there about 10 years. So it's indicated here that they'd given up all thought of returning back to Palestine. They wanted to establish a new life for themselves away from the poor and the destitute who had been there during the famine. But Mahlon and Chilion died also, both of them, and the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. And both men, though they were 10 years and married for some of those years to Orpah and to Ruth, died childless. Now that's not just a coincidence, brethren. Both men died childless. God cursed them. He permitted no children to be born of their marriages, and then he gradually caused all three men to die. Now this parallels us in the Church of God, brethren. We can choose to get away from the church because of the responsibilities that are upon us in being members of God's church. There are those who've got tired of the tithing system and helping the poor of this world and the spiritually destitute. They got tired of Mr. Armstrong's co-worker letters asking for extra offerings at times when the work would get into problems. And finally, there were those who decided they would just go back into the world and forget all this tithing bit. For a period of time, they might prosper. Remember, there was a 10-year period here that they were in Moab. The day will come when they will lose everything. And if they do not repent, they will die. If they're still alive, they will die in the tribulation. We cannot escape the responsibility to which we are called, brethren. We can go back out in the world and Satan can bless us for a period of time, yes, to keep us out of the church, to encourage us to stay out. I've seen people go out and actually improve their financial condition. Satan also blesses brethren. He's the God of this world. He has the power to do it. Remember, he offered blessings to Jesus Christ, showed him all the riches of the world and said, these will I give you if you fall down and obey me. Christ didn't deny that those riches were Satan's to give. Satan can bless in this world. So if somebody wants to go out of the church, Satan can keep them out. If money's what they want, he's more than happy to give it to them just to keep them out of the church. Of course, when the tribulation comes and the bottom falls out of this nation economically, then they lose everything. And then it's too late. They can't go to the place of safety. But this man sought his place of safety in the world. And it was no place of safety. He lost everything. She arose with her daughters-in-law, and that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab how God had visited his people in giving them bread. So the famine was now over. Wherefore, she went forth out of the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. Now, in the Orient, a parting really takes place in the house. You come to each other's homes and you leave. Generally, you part at the door. But in the Orient, you didn't do that. You walked with the people a certain distance of the way. And then when you were a few miles away from the home, that's when you said goodbye to them. In other words, you escorted them a part of the distance. So she went forth out of the place, her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go and return each to her mother's house. God deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. Because when the two sons were alive, they were evidently reasonably good wives to them, especially, I'm sure, Ruth. The Lord grant that you might find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. So what Naomi, their mother-in-law, was saying to them, and she was a good mother-in-law, she considered their welfare before her own. A lot of times mothers-in-law become very possessive of sons and daughters and interfere with marriages and things like that, or try to selfishly hold on to the affection of the younger generation. But she was willing to have them leave her so that they could find greater happiness than she felt that they could have with her. And she goes on to show why. So she was saying to them, go back, and you can find another husband of your own people, and this would be better for you. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice and wept. And they said to her, surely we will return with you to your people. Naomi said, turn again, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? By this time, she was probably beyond the age of childbearing, and she had lost her husband. And getting on in years, she was not likely to remarry. Turn again, my daughters. Now notice what she says to the two girls. Count the cost. These two girls were on their way in type to the promised land, to the kingdom of God in type. Just as you, when you get baptized, are counseled by the minister to count the cost. Because it is going to cost you something on your road to the kingdom of God. Turn again, my daughters, go your way. I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have an husband also tonight, and should also bear sons, I guess she wasn't past the age of childbearing, I'm sorry. Although she was getting on in years, because the Midrash says that Ruth was about 40 at this time. So the indications would be that she was 60. She may have just been, that Naomi was 60. She may have just been speaking metaphorically here. Is that the right word? I've forgotten. Anyway, you know what I'm trying to say. Would you tarry for them till they were grown? That would take another 20 years. Would you stay for them from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me much for your sakes. She cared about them. That the hand of the Eternal is gone out against me. She saw that the family had been cursed by God for this move, away from their responsibilities. Just like somebody quitting God's church. They lifted up their voice and wept again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave to her. Now notice the loyalty of Ruth here. And before we do, we might mention with Orpah that Orpah is a type of those of the many called and few chosen. She had a calling here to the kingdom of God, and she went part of the distance. She left the home in Moab, and she walked part of the distance on the way to the promised land of the world tomorrow. But when she counted the cost, she figured it was better to go back into the world. And there are those who were co-workers, prospective members that ride in for a visit. We go visit them. And they're willing to go just a certain distance, but they're not willing to go all the way. Orpah is a type of those people. They're in contact with the truth, they believe it, and they'll only go a certain distance, though. Ruth is the kind who's willing to go all the way. Naomi said to her, and Naomi's concern for them was matched by Ruth's concern for her. She said, verse 15, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods," which indicates that Orpah had given up her gods when she'd come into this Israelitish household. But now she was leaving a home of Israelites and going back to her Gentile people, and in consequence, to her gods. And that's the way it is with people who leave the church. When they go back into the world, they begin to seek the values of this world. "Return you after your sister-in-law." Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death part you and me." Now, those two verses are very famous in the Bible, and very beautiful words. In a sense, they're almost like the marriage covenant. This was daughter-in-law to mother-in-law, but you could almost read it for husband and wife. "Whether you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, will I die, and there will I be buried. And God do so to me and more also, if anything but death part you and me." And marriage is until death do us part. But this wasn't husband and wife, though the words could be taken in effect as that. Here was an act of loyalty to a widow and to a mother-in-law. And a lot of times in this world, there's not that kind of relationship with mother-in-laws. Mother-in-laws have got themselves quite a reputation, of course. I can remember when I was up in Canada, there was a sitcom called Mothers-in-Law. And all the ruckus they would stir up in the two families, these two mothers-in-law, by their wants, their likes, their dislikes, etc. Verse 18, "When she," Naomi, "saw that Ruth was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left speaking to her." Notice the character here of Ruth. A woman should have a right kind of determination and resolve. A woman may be the weaker vessel, but she should not be weak-willed. Soft, gentle, yes, but not soft in the head or weak-willed. "When she saw that she was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left speaking to her. So they two went until they came to Bethlehem." Now the expression in the Hebrew, "they two," indicates that both now were to be considered equals, and it demonstrates how precious the sincere proselyte is in the sight of God. That's a quote from the Cencino Jewish commentaries. Demonstrates how precious the sincere proselyte is in the sight of God, that the two now, they two, went as equals spiritually. Now, of course, they were not equals in rank in the sense that the mother-in-law should be the one to be the one in authority in a certain extent because of her age, but spiritually now, because Ruth was a sincere proselyte, they were considered spiritually equal. "Came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem that all the city was moved about them, and they said in amazement, is this Naomi?" A total contrast here with what they'd seen 10 years earlier. This family had left in great wealth because Elimelech was a mighty man In fact, he was descended, it would seem, from a prince of Judah, and Boaz also, because they were of the line of Pharez, as we're going to see, and from that line and from the marriage of Ruth and Boaz would not only come David, but also, of course, Jesus Christ. So they were amazed at what they saw. Their surprise was elicited by the tragic reversal of fortunes here that struck the inhabitants immediately. Here was an old woman, weary and worn, bearing the marks of sorrow and suffering. Could this be the wealthy lady that had left them? And perhaps a lady of sunny disposition, because Naomi does seem to have been overall a fine person as far as we can tell. The person that they'd known a decade ago. It was so totally different from the way they'd seen them leave. Here she came back without a husband, without her two sons, without any grandchildren, and with a proselyte Gentile. She said to them, "Call me not Naomi," which means pleasant, "call me Mara, bitter, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. God cursed us for what we did." Now, she followed her husband, so God let her live for her submission, but he cursed the husband and cursed the two sons for remaining, because evidently when the husband died, the two sons didn't say, "Let's return back to Palestine." They wanted to stay in Moab too. "I went out full," indicating abundance of wealth. "God has brought me home again empty." She went out with wealth, blessed with a husband and family. She came back empty, widowed, childless. "Why then call you me Naomi, seeing God has testified against me?" Testified against me for emigrating from the promised land that he gave to our fathers, emigrating to Moab. "And the Almighty has afflicted me." So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, which returned out of the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of the barley harvest. There's about a three-month period here in the spring that the barley harvest was to last. And so this whole story is during the spring harvest, a type of the first fruits. And Ruth, as I said earlier, is a type of the first fruits of the Gentiles to be brought into God's church. But notice that Ruth as a proselyte, I'm going to get my mouth wrapped around that word at some point, proselyte, is going, rather, a proselyte, oh, I don't know where I was now. Want to play the tape back? Let me start again. Notice, whatever it was I wanted you to notice, that Ruth was a Gentile, but in order to be a part of living in the promised land and a part of God's blessings, a part of the first fruits, she had to become a physical Israelite. And she was going to be married to an Israelite. God made that possible. God arranged the marriage, as we can see. So it is with the Gentiles today. You want to be a part of the first fruits of God's church. They have to become spiritual Israelites. Now, it's not that those who are already physical Israelites are any better than the Gentiles. Many of you Gentiles here are going to be ruling over physical Israelites in the world tomorrow. But in order to be a part of the first fruits, you have to become spiritual Israelites. Remember that the New Jerusalem has 12 gates, and over the gates are the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. Where are the Gentiles? The Gentiles become spiritual Israelites, and Israel as a whole is the bride of Jesus Christ. So everybody becomes an Israelite, because these promises were made to Abraham. And you Gentiles here in this room are not Gentiles anymore in God's church. You are spiritual Israelites in his sight, the equal of any physical Israelite in this room. Because in God's sight there is neither Jew nor Gentile, etc., etc., as it says in Romans. I did get that out, didn't I? Okay, chapter 2. Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth of the family of Elimelech. Now notice that this man too was a mighty man of wealth, indicating that Elimelech had been. And his name was Boaz. Now the name Boaz possibly means strength. There's some question as to the meaning of the name. But he certainly was strong in character, and as a type of Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ was perfect in character, strong. And Ruth, being friendship, became a friend of God, as each one of you are the friends of God, if we obey him. Let's see. There is a rabbinic tradition that Elimelech and Boaz were descended from Nahshon, a prince of the tribe of Judah, mentioned in Numbers chapter 1 and verse 7. So that would indicate again that they were very wealthy. Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Let me now go to the field and glean ears of corn. After him in his sight I shall find grace." There are the laws, Leviticus 19 verses 9 through 10, Deuteronomy 24 verses 19 through 22, whatever harvest is left of value in the fields, the vineyards or the orchards, could be claimed by the poor, passing strangers, or by widows. They could go and glean the corners of the fields. Whatever was left of the harvest, the poor could go into those fields, which were not their property, and pick up what was dropped and what remained from the harvest. It was one of the provisions God made in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. So she said to her, "Go, my daughter." And she went and came and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And her happenstance was to light on the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the kindred of Elimelech. Now it says her happenstance, but there's no coincidence here, brethren. And we should understand that by the rest of the story. God was working this out. Some things can be seem to be a coincidence in your life, but it's God guiding your life for you. And God here was guiding the line which was one day to bear Jesus Christ. "Behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, said to the reapers, 'God be with you.' And they answered him, 'The Lord bless you.'" Indicating here that he was a religious man, and obviously not all Israelites were. "Then said Boaz to his servant that was set over the reapers, 'Whose damsel is this?' And the servant that was set over the reapers answered and said, 'It's the Moabitish damsel that came back with Naomi out of the country of Moab.'" By the way, according to the Midrash, Ruth was 40 years of age. So as I mentioned, Naomi was probably about 60. And according to the Midrash, Boaz was 80 years old. So this was a late life marriage. But I question whether he was really 80. Ruth could have been 40. But knowing that women married a lot earlier back then, after 10 years or less as it would have been of marriage, she might have been about 30. But anyway, according to the Midrash, which is not the oracle of God, they say Ruth was 40, Boaz was 80. I would think they're getting on, but I would not necessarily think they'd gotten on that far. Anyway, that's a mute question. We can wait for the resurrection. It's not all that important. She said, "I pray you, let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." So she came and has continued even now, even from morning until now, except that she tarried a little in the house. So here again we see some of the character of Ruth. We see her loyalty to her mother-in-law, first of all in chapter 1. Now we see her character that she was a hard worker. As the paraphrased version puts it, she's been at it ever since morning, except for a few minutes rest in the shade. "Then said Boaz to Ruth, 'Hear you not, my daughter? Go not to glean in another field, neither go from hence, but abide here fast by my maidens.'" Notice he called her his daughter, so there was quite an age gap here. "Let your eyes be on the field that they do reap. Go you in after them, having not charged the young men that they shall not touch you." And undoubtedly, there was a danger for young girls going and reaping. When there were young men reaping there, that some of them would have suffered rape, sadly, and been bothered by the young men. "When you are athirst, go to the vessels, drink of that which the young men have drawn." Now, after we've gotten through chapter 3, we'll go over the 10 acts of kindness that Boaz showed to Ruth. There are 10 little things here, little kindnesses that he performed, 10 of them. The little things that are very important. Verse 10. Yes, verse 10. Then she fell on her face. I always have to... King James English. Have you ever fallen on your face? I did one time, and believe me, I didn't want to do it ever again. Did my face some damage, and I got some plastic in my mouth ever since because of it. And she fell on her face and bowed herself to the ground and said to him, "Why have I found grace in your eyes that you should take knowledge of me, seeing I am a stranger?" Boaz answered and said to her. Now, when he says he answered, the Hebrew signifies a raising of the voice here. In other words, he spoke for all to hear. "It has been fully showed me all that you have done to your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how that you've left your father and your mother in the land of your nativity, and are come to a people which you knew not here before, heretofore." This is a type of a person coming into the church. "All that you have done to your mother-in-law since the death of your husband." She put the church first, symbolically. There was no Church of God at this point. But she put the church first. And she left the world behind. "How you have left your father and mother, the land of your nativity, are come to a people which you knew not heretofore. As was the case when you entered the Church of God. You left the world behind, and you came into a room filled with people that you knew not heretofore. They were all strangers to you." Matthew 19, verse 27. Matthew 19, verse 27. Actually, that water's pretty good. Either San Francisco is improving its water, or that's bottled water. Verse 27. "Then answered Peter and said to Jesus, Behold, we've forsaken all." And Ruth forsook everything, all. She came with nothing into the promised land. Symbolically into the church, just as you had to forsake all coming into the church, in the sense of forsaking anything that stood in the way of your obeying God. "We have forsaken all and followed you. What shall we have therefore?" Jesus said to them, "Verily I say to you, you which have followed me in the regeneration, when the Son of Man shall sit on the throne of his glory, you also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And every one that has forsaken houses, or brethren, or sisters, or father, or mother, or wife, or children, or lands, for my name's sake." Ruth was such a person, and you are also. "Shall receive a hundredfold." You've got all kinds of mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters that you never had in this world, that you've got now in the church. "And shall inherit everlasting life. Many that are first shall be last, and the last shall be first." So this is what Ruth is a type of. She is a type of the Church of God, the first fruits. And being a Gentile, she signifies that the Gentiles are to become spiritual Israelites, just as she became a proselyte of the land of Israel. Verse 12, "The Lord recompense your work, and a full reward be given to you of the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you are come to trust." Just as you trust under the wings of God, those wings that shelter you, that protect you, and will take you to the place of safety if you are faithful. "Then she said, Let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for that you have comforted me, for that you have spoken friendly unto your handmaid, though I be not like unto one of your handmaids." Again, the humility here of Ruth. Loyalty. Hard work and diligence, humility. "Boaz said to her, At mealtime come you hither, eat of the bread, dip of your morsel in the vinegar." Now, how often do you dip your morsel in the vinegar? Some of you will get some ginger cookies and dip them in your coffee, perhaps, or you'll dunk your donut, but it's in coffee. Maybe some of you do it in tea, I don't know, but, you know, we've got a whole chain up New York called Dunkin' Donuts. Maybe you have them down here too. I think we do. They are better than Winchell's, I know that. And it's called Dunkin' Donuts because you dunk them in the coffee. But do you ever dunk stuff in vinegar? Can you imagine dunking your ginger bicky in the vinegar? That's what they call them in England. See, you have cookies, we have biscuits. Shortened to bickies. I don't know what the Australian term is. I'll have to find out. Whatever it is, it'll be funny. I can tell you that. This Hebrew word for vinegar here is chametz. It denotes an acid beverage, probably apple cider vinegar or sour wine, which mixed with a little oil. It was an Oriental drink, which is still popular today and apparently very refreshing. In hot weather, it is said to be particularly beneficial, allaying thirst, cooling the body, toning up the digestive system. So it was either sour wine or a little apple cider vinegar, and they would dip it in, and it would help stay their thirst in the hot, dusty area that they were working in. So she sat beside the reapers. He reached her parched corn. She did eat and was sufficed and left. When she was risen to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and reproach her not." So here it was more than just gleaning in the corners of the field. She could get in the middle of the field if she wanted, among the sheaves, he was telling her. And don't reproach her for it, do it. And what's more, let fall also some handfuls on purpose for her. Leave them, that she may glean them, and rebuke her not. Now, Boaz had no ulterior motive here. True, he married her later on, but he was not planning marriage at this point because he wasn't next in line, next of kin, to be the one to marry her. Plus, he was a much older man, so he wasn't expecting that she would be taken with him. But these little acts of kindness counted very much to Ruth. She got taken pretty quick with him. But this was just generosity on his part. And he didn't tell her that he was doing this. He said it privately to his men. Just as when it's possible to keep your generosity unknown, do so. As Jesus said in Matthew 6 and verse 1, when you give alms, don't, in verse 4 I guess it is of Matthew 6, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. In other words, don't let everybody see your generosity. Sometimes you can't help, but you know it cannot be done privately. But where it can be done privately, it should be. So he didn't tell this to Ruth. It was just something he did for her of himself without her knowing. So she gleaned in the field until even and beat out that which she gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. According to the Jewish commentary, this was probably enough to support Ruth and Naomi nearly a week. The Bible story says it was about 8 gallons, an ephah, enough to make many loaves of bread. So after one day of gleaning, she came home with a week's worth of barley. She took it up, went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she was gleaned, and her eyes opened wide. She brought forth, gave it to her what she reserved after she was sufficed, and her mother-in-law said to her, "Where have you gleaned today, and where have you wrought? Blessed is he that took knowledge of you. There's no way you made this pile of goodies without somebody giving you some special help." And she showed her mother-in-law with whom she had wrought and said, "The man's name in whose fields I work today, his name is Boaz." Now, you sort of watch here with Naomi. You see the matchmaker mentality immediately beginning to roll the wheels in her mind. Little wedding bells began to ding. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "Blessed be he of the Lord who has not left off his kindness to the living and the dead," to the dead, because he was caring for the needs of widows. And Naomi said to Ruth, "You know something, Ruth? The man is near of kin to us, one of our next kinsmen." Now, a kinsman had both rights and duties. He had the right of buying the property of his dead relative before it was offered for public sale. He was the avenger of blood in the event of a murder, and it was his duty to redeem a relative who sold himself as a slave. But also there was a law that if a brother or one near of kin died childless, then the next kinsman, or as it's actually translated in the Hebrew here, one that has the right to redeem,
could marry the widow by this law of God to raise up seed to the dead husband. So Naomi was thinking here, hey, guess what, Ruth? By this law of God, if this man is willing, he could be a hubby. And Ruth the Moabite said, he said to me also, you shall keep fast by my young men until they have ended all my harvest. In other words, he wanted her to stay in his field alone. He wanted to provide for her because he had heard of her good character, and also because he wanted to provide for both widows, Naomi because she was related, and Ruth because she was daughter-in-law. And she was a widow also, of course, Ruth. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maidens, that they meet you not in any other field. Maybe something more will come of this. So she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean until the end of the barley harvest, a period of about 3 months, and the wheat harvest, and dwelt with her mother-in-law. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Now, what did she mean when she says, shall I not seek rest for you? Chapter 1, in verse 9, when she was trying to tell them to go back home, she said, the Lord grant you that you may find rest, each one of you in the house of her husband. So her concept was, why don't I go hubby hunting for you, Ruth? And make a few suggestions here. Shall I not seek rest for you that it may be well for you? Naomi wanted to play matchmaker. She wanted to see another wedding. Now notice Naomi's unselfish concern, because as a mother-in-law she could have wanted to keep Ruth to herself in her own household, but she preferred to see Ruth married. She wanted Ruth's best interests kept at heart. And now is not Boaz of our kindred, with whose maidens you were? Behold, notice now that the plot thickens. This little conspiracy going on here in the matchmaking vein. Behold, he winnows barley tonight in the threshing floor. Now, Boaz was a man of wealth, but notice he assisted personally in the work. He wasn't above getting his fingers dirty. And we should have the same mentality. Wash you, therefore, anoint you. In other words, get yourself perfumed up, wash your hair, spruce up, put on your raiment upon you, and get you down to the floor. So get dressed up. Importance here of personal appearance. To the floor refers to the threshing floor. But make not yourself known to the man until he have done eating and drinking. You're going to have to sneak in there. See, this was all very sneakily done. It shall be, when he lies down, that you shall mark the place where he shall lie. You shall go in, uncover his feet, and lay you down. And he will tell you what you shall do. Now, to uncover his feet meant to draw the blanket that he was sleeping under and lay it upon herself. When a man put his garment on a woman, it was symbolic of a marriage proposal. And here she was going to take his blanket and put it on herself. As we'll see, verse 9, in fact, we can drop down to verse 9, the latter part of it. She says, spread therefore your skirt over your handmaid, for you are a near kinsman. First of all, she uncovered his feet, and he had a blanket over his feet, and lay there. That was a type of her proposing to him. And then asking him to take his skirt or his garment and put it over her was for him to accept her marriage proposal. We have an example of God doing this with Israel in Ezekiel chapter 16, which I read to you during the Feast of Unleavened Bread when we were talking about the feast being a love feast, as God's feasts are. Feasts of charity, as they're referred to in Jude. Ezekiel 16, and verse 8, God says of Israel in coming up out of Egypt, now when I passed by, this is referring to Israel in Egypt, and looked upon you, behold, your time was the time of love. So here is God as a lover, and he makes a proposal to her. The marriage actually took place on the day of Pentecost. So she was engaged, Israel was engaged to God after the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and then on the day of Pentecost they became married. And when I passed by you and looked upon you, behold, your time was a time of love, and I spread my skirt over you and covered your nakedness. A marriage proposal on the part of God. Yes, I swear to you, and entered into a marriage covenant, as it is, with you, said the Eternal, you became mine. So this is what Naomi was counseling Ruth to do on this particular evening. And Ruth was willing. Evidently, she was quite taken with Boaz. She said to her, all that you say to me, I will do. And she went down unto the floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. Now, undoubtedly, Ruth may have wanted to chicken out at some point. This was quite a bold move for a girl to make. She had the right to propose to him in this way, but also she knew she was risking getting rejected. And there must have been times when she wondered, should I do this or shouldn't I? But she obeyed the counsel and advice of her mother-in-law. So she went down to the floor, did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. As I said, it was the duty of the nearest eligible male kin of a dead husband to marry a widow in the event she had no children, so she might have opportunity to have offspring through the family that had chosen her. This is found in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 6. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, probably this was a celebration at the end of the harvest, we referred to it ending in the latter part of chapter 2, he went to lie down at the end of a heap of corn. She came in softly, notice she sneaked in there, so nobody would see or hear, uncovered his feet, hopefully he'd taken his socks off before he went to bed, and laid her down. It came to pass at midnight that the poor guy was afraid. You know, you're lying there sleeping and all of a sudden you feel this warm body. But you don't know it's a human being. I mean, it could be a snake, it could be a porcupine, whatever. It could be a skunk for all you knew that was right down. You bet it'll be kind of scary here. He was afraid. Not knowing what kind of animal might have decided that it was going to use his feet for body warmth. He turned himself, and surprise here, behold, a woman lay at his feet. Now, by the way, we are not recommending to any women in the church. We have different customs today, and I suggest you stick with them, because this would not be understood in modern 20th century society. And he said, who are you? And she said, I am Ruth, your handmaid. Spread therefore your skirt over your handmaid, for you are a near kinsman. So she had made a marriage proposal to him by getting under his blanket at his feet. She was asking him to accept the proposal by spreading his garment over her. He said, blessed be you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, inasmuch as you follow not young men, which again teaches us that Boaz was an older man, whether rich or poor. Now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to you all that you require. For all the city of my people doth know that you are a virtuous woman. Now, of course, some other woman had done this. If she had been of a lesser reputation, it would have been misconstrued. Now, regardless, he did keep it secret, and so there would be no falsifying of her reputation. But all the city knew that she was a virtuous woman, and he knew then that she did this in virtue, not out of an attempt to seduce him that night. Now it is true that I am your near kinsman. Now here came the real shocker and the blow to Ruth. Howbeit, there's a kinsman nearer than I. I bet her face got real flushed at this point. She turned bright red. She proposed to the wrong man. For the right man, because this was the man she loved. But unfortunately, there was someone else who was, if the law was to be followed, had right first to marry her. Tarry this night,
it shall be in the morning that if he will perform to you the part of a kinsman well, let him do the kinsman's part. But if he will not do the part of a kinsman to you, then will I do the part of a kinsman to you as God lives. Lie down until morning. So she lay at his feet until the morning. And she rose up before one could know another. Very, very early in the morning, and so there would be no sexual temptation here. And he said to God, and possibly to Ruth also, let it not be known that a woman came into to the threshing floor. He wanted to protect her reputation and probably prayed to God that it would not be discovered. And he said, while she was still there, bring the veil that you have upon you and hold it. When she held it, he measured 6 measures of barley, laid it on her, and she went into the city. When she came to her mother-in-law, she said, who are you, my daughter? Now, that's a dumb question at this stage of the game. It's an idiomatic expression, as the Revised Standard Version puts it. It should really be translated, how did you fare? How went the whole thing? You know, probably Naomi didn't sleep all night. She was probably chewing her fingernails. Boy, I wonder how this whole thing's going. And Ruth probably didn't sleep all night either when she found out that Boaz was not next of kin, that she'd proposed to the wrong man. She had proposed to the right one, as we understand, but she must have been feeling, oh, ghastly, what have I done? And praying, too, that the kinsman would say no and that she would get the man she loved, Boaz. And she told her all that the man had done to her, and she said, these 6 measures of barley gave he me, for he said, go not empty to your mother-in-law. Then said Naomi, sit still, my daughter. I bet Ruth had a hard time sitting still all day long. It was sound advice, stay calm and sit still, but I bet she was sitting on the edge of her chair if she was sitting still. Until you know how the matter will fall, for the man will not be in rest until he has finished the thing this day. Notice something here about Boaz's character. He was not a procrastinator. Of course, he was in love. And love knows no patience. When it's in the courting stages, I guess, it really wants to get things moving, generally. 10 acts of kindness that we've noticed here, little acts of kindness by Boaz. Verse 8 of chapter 2. Then said Boaz to Ruth, hear you not, my daughter, go not to glean in another field, neither go from hence, but abide here fast by my maidens. That's the first act of kindness. Stay here with mine. Verse 9, have I not charged the young men that they not touched you? I've given the young guys here special warning. Hands off. Second act of kindness, protection for her. And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink of that which the young men have drawn. Third act of kindness. You don't even have to bring your own water. You go drink of the water we've got. Verse 14, Boaz said to her, at mealtime, come you hither. Eat of the bread, dip your morsel in the vinegar. You don't have to eat at the side of the field. You come right here and eat with us. Fourth act of kindness. She sat beside the reapers and he reached her parched corn. A real gentleman here. Fifth act of kindness. Verse 15, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves. She doesn't have to glean on the corners. Let her get right in among the sheaves. That's his sixth act of kindness. What's more, seventh, let also some handfuls fall on purpose for her and leave them, that she may glean them and rebuke her not. Chapter 3 and verse 11, now, my daughter, fear not, I will do to you all that you require. Eighth act of kindness. Verse 14, he said, let it not be known that a woman has came into the floor. Ninth, protection of her reputation. And verse 15, he measured 6 measures of barley, laid it on her, gave her a special gift of food and groceries to go home with. 10 little acts of kindness. But it's the little things that count a lot in marriage, not just the big. Chapter 4. Then went Boaz up to the gate and sat him down there. And behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spoke came by, to whom he said, ho, such a one, turn aside, sit down here. He turned aside and sat down. Now the authoritative tone of voice here reveals the influential position held by Boaz, whom the Jewish commentators believe to have been a judge at this time. Remember, this was the period of the judges. They were not just big judges, such as you have in the book of Judges. There were little judges, too, and he was a judge in Bethlehem. But notice the name of the kinsman. We got the name of everybody else in the book, but not the name of the kinsman. Ho, such a one. That's his name. Such a one. How would you like to be called? Oh, hello, Mr. and Mrs. Such a One. Oh, boy. Strange people. He's such a one. What a weirdo. Why is his true name left out? The name was deliberately left blank in the Bible because this man wanted to make a name for himself. And because of his selfishness in wanting to make a name for himself, his name isn't recorded in the book that he would most like to have had it recorded in, the book of books, the Bible. And we'll see why as we go on. There are six major characters in the book, three of them selfish and three of them unselfish. Elimelech is a major character, selfish. Orpah is a major character at the beginning, selfish too. She wanted to go back to the world. We can understand why she did, but as I pointed out, she's sadly representative of those that come so close to getting into the church and turn their backs on it and don't make it in. Part of the many that are called, but the few that are chosen. And the reason they go back in the world generally is just plain selfishness. They want what's out there. They don't want to make the sacrifices for God. And yet in making the sacrifices for God, they're going to get great blessings. And the third selfish character is this kinsman. Three unselfish characters are, of course, Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. So as a contrast here as you go through the story, three that were selfish, three that were unselfish. And the three that were unselfish, in the end, got the greatest blessings because of what they were willing to give up. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit you down here." So notice this was a man of authority. And they sat down. And he said to the kinsman, "Naomi that has come again out of the country of Moab sells a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to advertise you, saying, buy it before the inhabitants, before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. If you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know. For there is none to redeem it besides you, and I am after you." And immediately, just as Naomi had heard the wedding bells dinging in her ears, this man saw the cash register and heard it ringing up, and he said, "I will redeem it." See, it would seem at first that he believed the land belonged solely to Naomi, and that his duty would end with the purchase of the field from her, hence his initial eagerness. So he says, "Sure, I'll take it. Grab." Then Boaz dropped the bomb. "What day you buy it of the field of the hand of Naomi, you must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance." In other words, the property would not be in the kinsman's name, but in the name of the widow he would marry, in the name of her former husband, which was Mahlon. And the kinsman said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar my own inheritance." His own firstborn son would not have been able to inherit. "Redeem you my right to yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now we need to understand here with the laws of Israel what exactly was going on. To mar his own inheritance meant he would cause a taint in the family pedigree. Each man wanted to maintain his genealogy because they knew that the Messiah was to come from one of the descendants of Pharez. And Boaz and Elimelech and this kinsman were descendants of the line of Pharez. And of course, the Messiah was to come from that line. They knew this. So each man wanted to maintain his genealogy and in his mind keep it pure, because they figured the Messiah could only come through a pure genealogy. If he married a Gentile, that in his mind would taint his genealogy. And so he would not have a chance of being one of those part of the line that might give birth to the Messiah. As I said, they figured it could come only from a pure line, so they wanted to keep the genealogy clean, in quotes. A wrong attitude here, an attitude of selfishness. This man was, in his mind, the one from whom Jesus Christ could have come. He didn't know the name Jesus Christ, but the Messiah could come from his line. But because of his selfish notice, it was overturned to Boaz. And the man that tried to preserve his pedigree lost out on the Messiah being born of his genealogy. Boaz, who was willing to give it up out of love for a proselyte in Israel, was the one through whom the Messiah did eventually come. There were many descendants to the line of Pharaohs, and they knew the Messiah was to come from one of those lines, so there was a big thing to keep their line pure. Let's see. Now, this was the manner in former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing, for to confirm all things. A man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor, and this was a testimony in Israel. Therefore, the kinsman said to Boaz, "Buy it for you." So he drew off his shoe. And Boaz said to the elders and to all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's, all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth, the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I purchased to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. You are witnesses this day." And then a very interesting prophetic statement by the people of Bethlehem. All the people that were in the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. The Lord make the woman that is come into your house, Ruth, like Rachel and Leah, which two did build the house of Israel." And of course, Ruth was a part in building the house of Israel, a Gentile woman, because from her line came Jesus Christ. "Which two did build the house of Israel? Do you worthily in Ephratah and be famous in Bethlehem?" Very interesting prophetic statement. Perhaps God inspired what went on in their mouths here, and they didn't fully understand the import of what they were saying. And Boaz and Ruth have become famous in Bethlehem, because of course they were the antecedents of, the ancestors of David and of Jesus Christ. "Let your house be like the house of Pharez, whom Tamar bare unto Judah." Tamar's situation was similar to Ruth, though Tamar, as far as we can tell, was not a Gentile, but she had a situation where seed had to be raised up to her as a widow. "Of the seed which the Lord shall give you of this young woman." So Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife. And when he went into her, God gave her conception, and she bare a son. Now, I said earlier on that when it said she happened upon the field of Boaz, that she didn't really happen upon it. God was directing her to that place. And it was God who gave her conception here. Remember, she had died childless, because God had not permitted Mahlon and Chilion to beget sons or daughters. God had either made both of them impotent, or he had sealed up the wombs of the two women, Orpah and Ruth. It was God. It was divine intervention here which enabled her to have children by the elderly Boaz and not by the young Mahlon. "And the women said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord, which has not left you this day without a kinsman.'" The actual word in the Hebrew is redeemer. And the redeemer here is not Boaz, but the newborn son, who removed the stigma of childlessness from Naomi. Because back then, if you were barren and you had no children, it was considered a stigma. Should not have been, but it was. The Jews particularly considered it a curse from God, when it was just one of those things in most cases. "He shall be to you a restorer of your life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, which loves you, which is better to you than seven sons, has borne him." Oh, a lot of times a man, when he gets married, wants to have a son. And that's fine, that's okay. But it most certainly should not be to the exclusion of daughters.
A man, when he gets married, and a woman, they should both want daughters, really, as much as they want sons. A lot of men want sons because they want to carry on their name, but of course we understand that we are a part of a spiritual household, and it's going to be a totally different situation for us as spirit beings. But a daughter that loves you is better than seven sons. So fathers should respect their daughters as much as they do their sons. And in fact, young girls need their dads as much as boys need their dads. If girls, as they grow up, are neglected by their fathers, they tend to become sexually loose. They tend to desire the attention of men, and if they don't get the proper fatherly attention from their dads, they tend to crave it from young guys in the world. Now, every girl will want attention from young boys in the world. But a lot of those girls who are sexually loose are so because there's a void in their life that their fathers did not fill for them as they were growing up. If they had had a proper fatherly concern, then the chances are they would not have been as predisposed to be sexually loose. Now, I'm not talking about a one-time mistake that some young women can make. I'm talking about girls that are boy-hungry in this world. Young girls need their dads as much as young boys do. Naomi took the child, laid it in her bosom, and became a nurse to it. And the women, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying, "There is a son born to Naomi," or born to Ruth. It was Ruth's kid, but it was born to Naomi, which is a nice way of looking at it. The stigma of childlessness was taken away from Naomi, not just from Ruth. And this was her redeemer, the young lad that would be a nourisher of her old age. She was finally a grandma. And they called his name Obed, and he is the father of Jesse, the father of David. And by the way, the name Obed means a servant. He was born to serve both God and man. It is true, by the way, that Naomi, of course, had sons. She was not childless in the sense she was barren. I may have made a misstatement there. Ruth was barren. But she had lost her sons. They had been taken away by God's curse. Now she was given a son again. This was a redeemer for her in her old age. So Obed was to be a servant, to serve both God and man. Now these are the generations of Pharez. Remember we mentioned that the Messiah was to come from the line of Pharez. Pharez begat Hezron, Hezron Ram, etc. Verse 20, Aminadab begat Nahshon, Nahshon begat Salmon. This Nahshon is the prince of Judah that I referred to earlier. Salmon, as far as we can tell, is the one that married Rahab the harlot. Tamar is in the line of Jesus Christ, who we mentioned earlier on. And that was something that came about by incest. And then Rahab the harlot, there was prostitution. Jesus Christ's line was not a pure line. With four of the women that were in it, two, there was sexual impropriety, and two were Gentile, but they were proselytes. Oh, sorry, one was Gentile. Who am I thinking of? I'm thinking of something else. But God was showing here that sex sins can be forgiven when people repent, and Jesus Christ came to bring about the forgiveness of those sins and all sins. And Rahab, when she repented and brought about the giving up of that city to Joshua, according to tradition, she married this Salmon. Salmon begat Boaz, Boaz begat Obed, Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. Now, as I mentioned earlier on, and particularly with relationship to verse 14, where it talks about the Redeemer, Ruth and Boaz are an Old Testament type of Mary and Joseph. And Ruth and Boaz are a type of the church and Jesus Christ. And Obed, who was the Redeemer, was a type of Jesus Christ himself. Hence his name, Servant, because Jesus Christ came to be a servant to all mankind. Okay, that's it for the Bible study. We'll see you this coming Sabbath, brethren.
of you interested in Webster's Dictionary, if you'd like to come forward, Mr. Walter Hale will take your names down.